It's brunt.
Okay. Yeah, okay, now I hear it. Yeah, I heard that. I don't know if I can do a Ferengi voice.
And I want to make it clear, I mean strips, not slips, of gold-pressed latinum.
Awesome.
I should do the whole podcast with this voice.
You could. You could. That would be one way to go.
Quark, you're through. I am liquidating this bar. You will never do business in the Ferengi Alliance again.
Not bad, not bad. I hear it now. It took a second, but I hear it.
This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 55 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me for the 55th time is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be discussing Ferengi virtue ethics. And Mike, it's great to actually have another episode on virtue ethics. It's been some time. I'm thinking way back to episode 7 of Metatrex when we covered Klingon virtue ethics. In fact, we may even have the beginnings of a virtue ethics series.
Well, Zachary, my greed has been satisfied for the day. I have so been looking forward to this conversation all the way back to episode 7, our episode on Klingon virtue ethics entitled Klingon Emily Post. I've been rattling chains and beating buckets, everything that I can to get this squeezed in here, and finally we're able to sit down and have this conversation. I am so looking forward to it.
And you're actually not exaggerating. I remember way back when we recorded episode 7 of Metatrex, you mentioned doing an episode on Ferengi virtue ethics, and frankly, you've mentioned it quite often ever since. And I've been putting it off because, frankly, I was sort of worried about my ability to have something great to say about Ferengi virtue ethics. So we'll see how we do tonight.
We'll see how we do, but I have to say that I love, love, love the Ferengi, particularly as they developed within the Star Trek universe. I mean, early on, they were very annoying and they were primitive, and you can only stand so many, you know, Ferengi lurking around, lurching and hissing, and you could only take so much of that. But as we saw them develop as a species, particularly in Deep Space Nine, I found them to be a very multifaceted, a very fascinating culture, a very fascinating species. And we actually, I think, see within Deep Space Nine a very complex, very nuanced group of characters in the Ferengi.
As we were preparing for today's show, Mike, I was thinking that this transition you mentioned from the way the Ferengi were depicted way back in season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation as fur-wearing, whip-wielding new villains of Star Trek The Next Generation, the change from that to what we see in Deep Space Nine with individual Ferengi with different personalities and a culture and a tapestry that's woven, the sort of rich character development we see over the course of Deep Space Nine, actually makes it a little difficult to have a generic discussion on Ferengi virtue ethics, because I think that change in depiction from what we see in season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation to what we see at the end of Deep Space Nine actually makes it a little difficult to have this discussion on Ferengi virtue ethics, because I think the characterization of the Ferengi changed over time. So when we're talking about Ferengi virtue ethics, we have to decide, are we talking about season 1 Star Trek The Next Generation Ferengi, or are we talking about the richly developed culture of the Ferengi that we see at the end of Deep Space Nine?
And that you raise an excellent point, and I do go into this with a little bit of caution, because I realize that for a lot of fans, the Ferengi are the Jar Jar Binks of the Star Trek universe. They became, by and large, this comedy trope that Star Trek writers would pull out, especially during Deep Space Nine, for a little comedy relief. And sometimes that comedy worked and sometimes it didn't. And Quark is an incredibly popular character. I think Nog is widely accepted. Rom is by some fans tolerated, although I have a love and appreciation for Rom as a character. But the Ferengi as a whole just sort of, as I said, became this comedy trope. So I know that there are probably some fans listening to us right now, Zachary, who are going to go, oh, they're talking about Ferengi and I don't want to listen to this, and might be tempted to turn this off. And I would just say, you know, stick around, hang around, and hopefully in the course of the conversation, we can hang sort of the Ferengi in a new light and allow you an opportunity to appreciate them from a different perspective.
Well, in the way of opening thoughts, it occurred to me that what Star Trek did with the depiction of the Ferengi, the change from season one of The Next Generation to how they were depicted at the end of Deep Space Nine, with all of the comedy foils that you described, I think that's very much in line with how Star Trek thinks of enemies. When the Ferengi were first introduced, they were the new bad guy. They were something to be afraid mm-hmm. of. And over the course of the next many years, we see a progressive declawing of the enemy and a humanizing of the enemy to the point where the Ferengi actually end up becoming almost more relatable than the humans in some cases in Deep Space Nine.
Indeed, indeed. I hold here, Zachary, in my hot little hand, a copy of the Ferengi Rules of Acquisition. And you have to be very careful because there are a lot of copies out there on the internet of the Ferengi Rules of Acquisition. And I haven't sat down at any point in time and actually counted the number of these rules. Perhaps I should, that were actually spoken on screen, but there were quite a many of them that were actually spoken on screen. It's not a complete list by any measure because there were lots of gaps, but surprisingly, a lot of the rules of acquisition were mentioned directly on screen, especially during the run of Deep Space Nine. And I think the rules of acquisition are really a very interesting window into the character of the Ferengi as a species, and we learn a lot about their virtues and their ethics through them.
Mike, I'm so glad you thought to bring a copy of the Rules of Acquisition insofar as we know them, because I think that raises the fundamental question about how to think about Ferengi and ethics. Insofar as the Ferengi have a set of rules, the Rules of Acquisition, you could plausibly say that the right way to think about Ferengi ethics is in terms of deontological or Kantian ethics. And it wouldn't be Kantian in the sense of respect for for other sentient beings and the things we think of as Kantian ethics, but just this deontological rule-based ethics. Is that what defines Ferengi ethics? Or should we focus more, as we started the discussion characterizing this as virtue ethics, by focusing on Ferengi character traits? And sometimes that can be a false dichotomy, I think. I think the fact that there are so many rules of acquisition, as you run through the rules and start to categorize them and think of the things that really do define these rules of acquisition, does that reveal certain essential characteristics of the Ferengi and their ethical views and their character traits, or is it more rule-based for the Ferengi? Do you know, as you read through the Rules of Acquisition, which I have to admit I've not taken the time to read all 200. How many did you say there were?
Well, I think unofficially there are something to the tune of 285, but again, only a handful of them were actually mentioned on screen. Well, I say a handful, but there are actually surprisingly quite a many of them mentioned on screen, certainly not all 285. So there are lots of published versions of the Rules of Acquisition online. I have a copy in my hand that is probably one of the more unofficial ones. I have cross-referenced it to what is on Memory Alpha, and I've kind of highlighted the ones that, you know, are official rules, but there are also lists of unofficial rules, things that popped up in novels and other, other sources out there that aren't necessarily canon.
So as you read through the list of rules of acquisition, do you get a sense that the rules are useful for the Ferengi more from a rule-following standpoint, like, you know, in order to be a moral Ferengi, you follow these rules? Or do those reveal, are they more important for the Ferengi in terms of developing what the Ferengi perceive as their own virtuous character traits, how to be a quote-unquote good Ferengi?
I think the quote-unquote good Ferengi is a Ferengi that follows the rules of acquisition. And I think that's evident in the way that oftentimes their conduct as they are reasoning these things, at least as we see it on screen, as they're reasoning through their actions and, you know, their course of behavior, they will reference the rules of acquisition and sort of compare or contrast what they're doing to see how well it fits into these rules of acquisition, or really a code of conduct for the Ferengi species. So I think they are more rule-based.
So insofar as you've actually done this deep dive into the rules of acquisition, which, again, I admittedly have not done, do you get some sense from those rules of acquisition of what the essential Ferengi virtues are? Can you categorize these rules of acquisition into sort of families of rules, like some rules about business, some rules about trade, some rules about education, some rules about other things? Like, can you categorize them in that way, or do they all fit basically the same pattern? You know, I guess what I'm trying to see if we can get at is, can we, you know, whittle down this essential list of Ferengi virtues to some small number of virtues? You know, taking that list of 280 some odd rules and getting it down to a list of 5 or 6 Ferengi character traits that define a good Ferengi.
Well, that's what's really interesting, Zachary, and we can dive right into, you know, what is essential as far as Ferengi virtues are concerned. I think, obviously, you know, most fans would associate Ferengis with profit. You know, this idea of generating profit, it is central, it is fundamental to the character and conduct of a Ferengi. A Ferengi that is successful, you know, kind of this uber Ferengi, is going to be a successful, profitable Ferengi. They've got Latinum in the bank, you know, they've got business in the pipeline. It all kind of circulates around commerce. However, within the rules of acquisition, we find rules that deal with various things such as friendships, familial relationships, also, in dealing not only with business associates, but with friends. So the rules of acquisition, even though at the very heart of them, it's all about turning a profit, it's all about, you know, getting Latinum in the bank, at the heart of these rules of acquisition is really a very complex set of guidelines that really govern every aspect of life. And that includes, you know, family and friends and relationships and you name it. For instance, Zachary, I mentioned familial relationships, and I'm looking at rule of acquisition number 139, which says wives serve, brothers inherit. And again, it's all about Latinum, it's all about profit, it's all about business. But in that, we learn something about their attitudes towards women. We learn something about their familial relationships with their brothers. And I find it incredibly fascinating.
The way you're describing this, with profit being this underlying motivator for all Ferengi action, is intriguing to me, and it seems to match up pretty well with what we see on screen. On screen, we see lots of different Ferengi involved in lots of different things. You know, we see Rom, who wants to be an engineer or a part of the maintenance crew on Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. We see Nog, who wants to go off to Starfleet Academy. We see Damon Bach, who's motivated by revenge almost more than profit. Yes. But despite that diversity of actions and motivations, profit is this underlying motivator that colors or shapes all of those other motivations or all those other actions. In the case of Nog, we hear Nog saying, you know, I might be a Starfleet cadet, but I'm still a Ferengi. I still know how to find things. In the case of Rom, he still knows how to run a business. In the case of Quark, obviously, he's the clearest example of someone who's always motivated by profit. Mm-hmm. No matter how altruistic we see Quark be, and we do see him become altruistic at a certain point in Deep Space Nine, but profit is still this underlying motivator. And of course, in the case of Damon Bach, his first officer ends up relieving him of command because of his unprofitable motive in seeking revenge against Captain Picard. So I would say that no matter what the Ferengi are involved in, no matter how diverse or how pure their motives, profit is always this underlying factor, this underlying motivation that is driving even those seemingly diverse and seemingly altruistic behaviors.
Well, sure. And we see clear exceptions, or at least what we perceive to be exceptions in the Star Trek universe to this, Rom being, you know, probably an obvious one. You know, Rom doesn't seem to be motivated by profit, but also we see him willing to kill his own brother for profit for his stake in the bar. But Rom is also very good with his hands. He's very technical and able to fix things. But, you know, even for good Ferengi, that's certainly a way to make profit. In
Rom is downright curious about how things work. I mean, learning about things seems to be a virtue for Rom.
Yeah, without a doubt. And Nog certainly was influenced by and large by the Federation. Probably his friendship with Jake, I think, informed his character a great deal. And we see him willing to, you know, go off and prove himself in Starfleet and join the Academy and become a Starfleet officer. In The Next Generation, we see Zachary, a Ferengi scientist, whose interest doesn't really necessarily lie in something that he's able to acquire, but rather what he's able to discover. So the Ferengi are interesting and varied.
And of course, while we're talking about different Ferengi that we see in the Star Trek universe, we would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about Moogie, Quark and Rom's mother, who, for all of her nurturing maternal ways, does in fact just want to seek profit, and she's forbidden from doing so according to Ferengi law, but she's pushing back against those conventions and those standards and fighting for her own gender equality. But for her, gender equality means the ability to earn profit.
Yeah, and I love Moogie, I really do. And both iterations of her, she was masterfully played by two separate actresses, and I think both of them brought some interesting perspectives to the character. And you're absolutely right, her quest for gender equality was to do that which was considered good for a Ferengi to earn profit. But even in that, Zachary, you know, she represents kind of a paradigm shift within the culture of the Ferengi, because as you've already mentioned, they were suppressive towards women. Women were not allowed to wear clothes. Women were not allowed to earn profit. And so she really kind of destroys the paradigm in the Star Trek universe. She's very unique in that sense. And
in the Delta Quadrant, the Ferengi actually wear lobe-shaped jewelry. And everyone else does as well.
I'm looking at you know, the rules of acquisition. I mentioned a Ferengi scientist from Star Trek: The Next Generation. Of course, that's Dr. Rega. And while Dr. Rega seems certainly unique in the fact that he mentions as much. He says, you know, it's something that's not widely accepted. You know, he's an oddity of sorts because he's a Ferengi scientist. And, you know, I'm reminded of Rule of Acquisition 74, which says knowledge equals profit. So really, at the end of the day, for a Ferengi to invest himself in science, and certainly there is the thrill of discovery, but that discovery also can equal profit. Rom's ability to fix things and work with his hands certainly can equal profit. So knowledge equals profit. So for a species that, you know, suppress women and look down on Ferengi who are scientists, engineers, and Starfleet officers, they do value knowledge.
Something has always struck me a little odd about the way that the Ferengi are depicted in the Star Trek universe. I mean, any warp-capable species that has starships that are capable of warp drive, they're going to need scientists, and they're going to need engineers, and they're going to need teachers. And we don't get to see too many of these people inside the Star Trek universe. I mean, we do get to see Rom more or less essentially learning to be an engineer, or at least an engineer in training. And I guess we do get to see Quark being a math teacher in the episode Children of Time. We get to see a holographic recreation of Quark giving math lessons to students inside that alternate timeline. In fact, after seeing Quark depicted as a math teacher in that episode Children of Time and that alternate timeline, I kind of imagine Quark back on Deep Space Nine on the promenade selling his own version of Speak and Spell, like Quark Speak and Spells. Yeah, I envision this Quark Speak and Spell kind of teaching math and teaching economics and teaching finance and teaching accounting.
Well, Zachary, as Rule of Acquisition 9 says, opportunity plus instinct does equal profit. So I say we can mass market those for sure.
Quark Speak and Spells would be highly profitable.
It's all the rage on Ferenginar. I hear it's next year's big Christmas gift.
Last year was Tickle Me Worf. This year it's
Quark speaking spells. When you tickle Worf, he says,
"Sir, I protest. I am not a merry man.
We have completely gone off the rails.
Do you think to complete the toy trifecta, we need a pull-string action figure of Captain Sisko?
Actually, Zachary, I'm thinking Commander Riker. When you pull the string, he puts his foot up on something.
You see? You see? They are insane!
Even better than that would be the Captain Picard pull-string action figure. When you pull the string, he straightens his tunic.
Actually, I think Riker was trying to work on something like that. If you recall the episode where he had the little doll that the child had made on Picard Day.
Captain Picard Day, absolutely.
Yeah, Captain Picard Day. I think number one was going to go figure out how he could put a pull string in the back, and very well, number one. So it spoke.
If I remember, Captain Picard was not amused, but Riker tried to take the Captain Picard doll onto the bridge, mimicking Captain Picard, "I'll be on the bridge."
We have a whole line of new Star Trek toys for all of you fans out there. Stay tuned.
So
coming to our Redbubble store very soon.
It is the Quark Speak and Spell, the Tickle Me Worf doll, and the pairing of the Commander Riker and Captain Picard pull-string action figures.
I like it. Make it so.
Proceed.
Well, Mike, as fun as it is to talk about Quark's very profitable side toy business on the promenade, I do want to bring it back to virtue ethics and ask a very fundamental question. Are these character traits that we're talking about, the Ferengi character traits, are they inherent biological or psychological characteristics of Ferengi as a species, or are they merely desirable learned behaviors that the Ferengi have as a whole? I mean, any species has its instinctive behaviors. My cat has instinctive behaviors. You could argue that humans have an instinctive behavior, a drive towards developing language and culture, and the birds up my window, they have very instinctive behaviors in terms of how they gather their food and raise their young. And any species has these innate instincts and drives towards certain behaviors. You could argue that the Ferengi have this innate drive towards profit that accounts for the fact that profit colors all of their actions in the way that we've talked about previously. On the other hand, you could argue that this drive towards profit is merely culturally reinforced. It's such a strong cultural virtue for the Ferengi that this drive towards profit is more of a learned behavior rather than instinctive behavior. Do you, in your reflection of Ferengi and in reading through the rules of acquisition, do you get a sense that this drive towards profit is instinctive for Ferengi, or is it a learned behavior?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think it's one that we get kind of a confused message within the Star Trek universe about as we explore whether or not this is something that is biological, psychological, whether it's something that's learned. I think that there are a few places for us, touchstones, if you will, for us to kind of stop and explore. And not all of them have to do with Ferengi. I think generally within the Star Trek universe, it is accepted that for most species, their behavior is learned. We see this time and time again throughout the Star Trek universe. We take, for instance, in The Next Generation, we take a human and he is raised by a alien culture that is very warrior-like. And so, you know, he becomes very suspicious of other human beings and he becomes very warrior-like.
And in fact, in The Next Generation, we see Worf, who was raised by humans, and certainly has adopted human virtues and human behaviors as a result of having been raised by humans, even despite his Klingon instincts.
Absolutely. In Deep Space Nine, we see a Cardassian who was raised by Bajorans, and he's actually raised with a bigoted attitude towards other Cardassians. He's very Bajoran in his attitudes. And so that brings me to the Ferengi. And as we mentioned before, we have a very broad sense of who the Ferengi are because we have such a varied group of characters to kind of draw from. We have the quintessential sort of Ferengi character in Quark, at least when we first meet him. And certainly Brunt is another character that comes to mind that's very much in the mold of the traditional Ferengi. But we also see, again, Dr. Rega, who is a scientist, Rom, who is very able with his hands and very giving, very benevolent, very loving. toward his Mugi, which I think is a general attitude towards Ferengis, but again, in a culture and a society that oppresses women into a sort of servitude, Ram was very supportive of his mother wearing clothes and earning profit. And so we find that to be very unique. We also see, for instance, a Ferengi who is a mercenary, not concerned with profit at all, just give me an opportunity to kill or maim somebody. So I think the Ferengi, like most species, I think there's an argument that can be made that this is not so much a biological or inherently psychological drive for them, but rather one that is learned, it's taught, it's passed down through the indoctrination of these rules of acquisition and these kind of apprenticeship sort of relationships that exist, especially, it seems, between brothers. I think that there's a precedent in the Star Trek universe that, you know, you have family members who kind of look out for one another and who apprentice one another in business and teach them profit. Cousins, even. We see that relationship in Enterprise, their only Ferengi episode. You know, it was the relationship between these cousins, and, you know, the one cousin was subservient to the other cousin, and he was kind of learning because he didn't have the lobes for business, but my cousin's teaching me, and so we see that kind of precedented. So again, I think there's certainly some evidence there that it's something that is learned in their behavior.
You know, as I think about this question of nature versus nurture and which Ferengi character traits are instinctive and which are learned behaviors, it strikes me that the character of Nog in Deep Space Nine is structurally similar to the character of Worf in The Next Generation. Worf's character is a fish out of water. He's raised by humans and he's adopted human behaviors and human mannerisms and human virtues, but still has certain Klingon instincts and even a drive to understand more about his Klingon heritage. And in fact, there are some Klingon biology involved. You know, Worf has certain instinctive reactions that are Klingon in nature. And Nog is similarly a fish being raised out of water, right? He's a Ferengi that's not being raised on Ferenginar. He's being raised on what is now a Federation space station, mm-hmm. Former Cardassian space station, but now it's a Federation space station, Deep Space Nine, mostly around humans and other Federation species, far removed from his Ferengi culture. And, you know, he certainly has Ferengi influences. He has Quark, who's by far the strongest business influence on Nog. We see his father, Rom, as an influence on Nog in other ways. But largely, Nog is affected by Jake and by the other Federation/Starfleet role models there on Deep Space Nine. So it's an interesting question to me, and I don't think it's really easy to tell which of Nog's character traits, which of his personality features developed as a result of his interaction with humans versus his interaction with Ferengi, and which of his Ferengi characteristics, because Nog, as much as he acculturates to the point where he's joining Starfleet and going to Starfleet Academy, Nog remains a Ferengi. He likes the business aspect of things. Mm-hmm. He likes being the guy who knows how to make deals, mm-hmm. and get things done. You know, he's very Ferengi at his core. Is that an instinctive behavior, or is that something he's learned from Quark or learned from Rom? I don't think it's really easy to tell, but I think you could arguably say that Ferengi have this instinctive drive towards profit in some biological or instinctive sense, just like Worf's, you know, reactions in a fight are very Klingon in nature as a result of his Klingon biology. I don't think we know enough to really settle the issue, but you could make a case either way that, sure, even though Nog is being raised largely around humans, his uncle is there and his father is there, and he does have a strong Ferengi influence, even despite being a fish out of water. On the other hand, you could argue that he has so much of an influence of the Federation in terms of his virtues that any Ferengi manifestations are actually his innate biology and his instincts coming to fruition rather than his learned behaviors that he got from other Ferengi. And again, I just don't think we get enough information to know. It's probably a little bit of both, but it's an interesting kind of thought experiment to ask, you know, are the fact that all these Ferengi, despite their diversity, the fact that they are collectively influenced by profit in any, you know, in all of its various ways, is that an argument for the innateness of the drive towards profit, or is that an argument for the strong cultural presence of profit as a cultural virtue?
I think I'm glad you kind of gravitated towards Nog for this reason, Zachary. I think he's really one of these linchpin characters that we can actually discover a lot about, not only the Ferengi, but the Federation. And I say that because when we first meet Nog, he's very much a Ferengi boy, and he is sort of under his uncle's thumb, but the Federation has moved into that space station, and everything is about to change. And so there are a couple of episodes in which we really see Nog's character kind of weighing the juxtaposition of the Federation and the Ferengi Alliance. And he really comes to the decision that he wants to join Starfleet by his own admission, because he's seen his father struggling in this society in which if you don't make a profit, if you're not a successful business person, then you're nothing. And so there is some fear and some trepidation that he might not have the opportunities and might not be as good in business as his Uncle Quark. But he sees the Federation in which your sum worth is what you are able to bring to the table, and you're valued for who you are, and you're taught, you're educated, and you're given equal opportunity. And I emphasize the word equal. And so he joins Starfleet. He really breaks the paradigm in his culture, much to his uncle's chagrin. And he becomes a Starfleet officer. But the beautiful
thing... He even drinks root beer.
He loves root beer. But the beautiful thing here, Zachary, is he doesn't cease to be a Ferengi. He's still very much a Ferengi. In Treachery, Faith, and the Great River, we see him really schooling Chief O'Brien on the virtues of the Ferengi. And really teaching Chief O'Brien a thing or two about, you know, negotiating and learning the customer, who is that, you know, that person that he needs to trade with or trade for, whatever the case may be. And so we see that. We see that he still has this very competitive drive. We see that in the episode The Visitor, in which, you know, an older Nog, who has become a Starfleet captain, is, you know, very driven, and he's having a conversation with Jake there in Jake's home, and he's kind of laughing about the fact that he's, you know, he's young and he's a captain, and I'm going to be an admiral one of these days. And so we see that kind of, you know, drive to succeed. So he doesn't cease to be a Ferengi, but his priorities shift a little bit, and he sees that he can have an equal opportunity within Starfleet, within the Federation, that he may not necessarily be able to have within Ferengi society. And so that juxtaposition really brings him to a place where he can say, you know what, I feel comfortable in saying that I'm going to take a different path than my father or my uncle. And I think that's really cool.
I'm glad you thought to mention that several times in Deep Space Nine, the Ferengi are in the positions of having to teach something to the humans. And this is a very interesting moral reversal that's taken place, because oftentimes the humans kind of take the moral high ground in Star Trek, and they look at other alien races and see faults of the alien races. You know, we don't want to be too Klingon-like because we'll be too warlike. We don't want to be too Romulan-like because we'll be too scheming. Mm-hmm. We don't be too Ferengi-like because we'll be too greedy. In reality, those alien races represent certain features of human nature that we don't happen to find ideal in ourselves. But in the Star Trek universe, the humans are sort of idealized versions of humans, and the alien races depict the worst of human nature in a lot of cases. But with the Ferengi in Deep Space Nine, you see a very interesting moral role reversal, where it's the Ferengi who are taking the moral high ground and saying, look at these stupid humans in this war with the Dominion. They're going to fight to the death, when the Ferengi would be the ones to sit down over a negotiating table and do a deal and do a bargain that everyone could live with, and we would preserve our civilization. And look at the stupid humans are going to fight this to the death.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you know, they end up holding their place among the Federation. Although, a rule of acquisition 285, no good deed ever goes unpunished. So I'm sure there will probably be some repercussions for that. But yeah, it's interesting that even as a society, the Ferengi are able to kind of set things aside and really, you know, stand with the Federation during a time when, yeah, they probably could have gone to the negotiating table and had some place of power within the Dominion.
I get the sense that sometimes the Ferengi are unfairly depicted as being motivated by profit to the point of being greedy. You could argue the flip side of that is that they are motivated by the urge and the desire to do a good deal, right? And that's not quite the same motivation, right? The urge to obtain a profit is not quite the same as being a good negotiator or being able to outwit your opponent in a negotiation. It's almost a diplomatic element to it that if you put a Ferengi down at a negotiating table, you're going to walk away with a good deal. And that's not necessarily motivated by profit. It's almost a type of performance art that you're motivated by one-upping the other side in a negotiation, or at least reaching a compromise, a negotiation or a deal or a compromise that everyone can live with. That in itself seems to be a virtue for Ferengi, profit aside. Is that an overly charitable reading of the Ferengi's negotiating skills?
No, I don't think at all. In fact, they're very keen negotiators. And the thing that I appreciate about the Ferengi is that they are very flexible and able to turn on a dime. I mean, we really see that in the way they handle things with the Federation. It's almost a comical scene in which Quark was ready with two different banners depending on, you know, the way the campaign to retake Deep Space Nine turned out. We see the flexibility. Going to the rules of acquisition, Rule 34.
I was going to say there has to be a rule of acquisition for that.
Well, Rule 34, war is good for business. Rule 35 is peace is good for business. So, you know, that demonstrates their incredible flexibility, their ability to turn on a dime. Rule of acquisition number 76, once in a while declare peace. It confuses the hell out of your enemies. I mean, it's just this incredible tapestry, I think is the word you used earlier, that really mark this amazing species, this remarkable species within within the Star Trek universe.
There's something almost stoic to the Ferengi. No matter which way the political winds blow, no matter which way a war goes, whether it's a war, whether it's peace, no matter which power factor is in charge, the Ferengi are there willing to go with the flow and go where the winds blow and make a profit regardless. So there's something just about accepting whichever direction things are going and not fighting against it too hard that seems to be a Ferengi virtue that's almost stoic in nature.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Zachary, because I was thinking the exact same thing. In fact, we had a conversation a while back on stoicism. And as I read through some of the Ferengi rules of acquisition, I can't help but think to myself that it very much resembles in places things that perhaps you would expect to at least read between the lines when you're reading, say, Marcus Aurelius.
Are you reading from the unpublished works of Quarcus Aurelius?
Quarcus Aurelius.
Yeah, that's actually the rule of acquisition number 287. Jokes are good for business.
Latinum lasts longer than lust. Never allow doubt to tarnish your lust for latinum. I mean, those are very stoic kind of statements there. I've mentioned several of these, but it amazes me how stoic some of these statements are. And when we look at that, that was rule of acquisition 229, latinum lasts longer than lust. And that's a very stoic statement when you think about it in that not to allow your personal passions for another human being to get in the way of your objective. That's a very stoic attitude.
I'm not sure if I remember Marcus Aurelius saying that unchecked emotions aren't profitable. But if Marcus Aurelius were motivated just a little bit more by profit, I could see him saying that.
Well, I can hear Marcus Aurelius in Rule of Acquisition number 190. Hear all, trust nothing. That comes from Deep Space Nine, Call to Arms.
Why is that stoic?
I find that very stoic because it really, it really connotes this idea that as you're keeping your ears open, not to allow it to influence your judgment in any way, shape, or form, to hear it, but not to allow it to influence your judgment.
I guess I hear something slightly different in that quote. I hear that you should hear everything, but trust nothing, so you should be afraid of everything, and that can lead to a very unstoic result.
Yeah, I don't really hear that. I hear a statement rather that that connotes the idea that, you know, you shouldn't allow the things that you should be informed, but not allow those things to cause you to waver. Here's one, number 102, nature decays, but Latinum lasts forever. that's a very stoic attitude. I can see Quark sitting there, you know, as some Dabo girl is stroking his lobe, giving him umox, and he's imagining her decaying, and he's thinking about the business deal that he's got going on, and, you know, yeah, that umox feels pretty good, but, you know, she's nothing but a collection of bones and blood vessels and muscle and...
Well, Mike, let's dwell on this quote for just a minute. Nature decays, but Latinum lasts forever. There's part of this quote that is very stoic. The ancient Stoics did have the sense of nature decaying, that all things are finite, mm-hmm. and nothing lasts forever. So you shouldn't be too invested in anything, given that your own life isn't going to last. The things you're investing your time and energy and your passion about aren't going to last. Everything will decay over time. So you should try to focus on things that last. But I think the deeper point is that nothing lasts. You're not going to be able to take your Latinum with you. You're not going to be able, you know, eventually even the Latinum will, it won't decay per se, but if you think far into the future, even the Latinum itself will perish with the end of the solar system or the end of the galaxy or the end of the universe. So you can't take it with you. So there's part of this that doesn't ring very stoic. Even by focusing on Latinum so much, that's investing too much of your concern and care and mental energy into something that itself you can't take with you to the grave and isn't going to last forever anyway. So I don't see that as being particularly stoic.
Yeah, it seems rather contradictory. And you're certainly right. You can't take your Latinum with you. But we also know, for instance, rule of acquisition number 125, you can't make a deal if you're dead.
I actually have an amendment to this rule. I thought of a new rule of acquisition that is much more stoic. You can't take your Latinum with you, so you might as well spend it on a good time in a holosuite. That sounds like a Ferengi rule of acquisition that sounds a little more stoic to me.
That's actually on the advertisement flyers that Quark hands out at the airlock.
You can't take your Latinum with you, so you might as well spend it on a good time in a holosuite at Quark's.
Quark's holosuites, the best in the galaxy.
Well, Mike, we've been spending a lot of time talking about character traits and virtues that are uniquely Ferengi, but like all culturally specific virtues or character traits, we need to ask the question, how should those character traits or personality traits or virtues be perceived by people who are not a part of that society? How should Ferengi virtues be viewed by members of Starfleet and citizens of the Federation in this case? I mean, on the one hand, you could argue that the attitude should be one of tolerance, that the Ferengi have their own unique culture, and the Federation and Starfleet are not in the business of going out and forcing Federation culture on other societies. On the other hand, you could argue that many times in the Star Trek universe, we see that there's a cultural progression towards Federation ideals. In fact, even in Deep Space Nine, we see talk of a kinder, gentler Grand Negus and a gentler Ferenginar that is much more in line with what you would think of as human or Federation virtues than, strictly speaking, Ferengi virtues. So you could argue that over time, these things that sound like innate Ferengi character traits are actually doing the Ferengi a disservice, and that as they become progressively more interwoven with other species in the galaxy, they will become more diplomatic, they will become kinder, they'll become gentler, they'll become more Federation-like. So are the Ferengi on this trajectory towards increasingly human or increasingly Federation virtues, or should those Ferengi virtues, things like profit, things like greed, things like hard negotiating skills, things like being willing to do questionable things in the name of profit, should those things be tolerated and respected, or are those remnants of a culture that is on a trajectory towards more like what we see in the rest of the Federation?
Questionable things to gain profit? Zachary, you should remember rule of acquisition number 239, never, be afraid to mislabel a product. That is not questionable. No, Zachary, you ask a very good question, and I've got to say that I think that the answer to that question can really be found throughout the Star Trek universe as we encounter Ferengi within the Federation. And I look at the attitudes of various characters who respond in different ways to the Ferengi. For instance, you have Worf, who is very irritated by the Ferengi. I mean, he says it with such disdain. He hates the Ferengi.
He wouldn't even call Quark by name. He just calls him
the Ferengi. For instance, Kira, who's very irritated at the behaviors of Quark. And it's not just Quark, it's all of the things that make him Ferengi that irritate her. Sisko, I think, tolerates Quark because Sisko has learned the art of diplomacy. He needs Quark. He can use Quark. So Quark is a commodity, something that is valuable to Captain Sisko, Commander Sisko. And so he tolerates him. I don't think he particularly likes him, but he tolerates him. And you know, I think about the relationship that exists between Odo and Quark. We really haven't talked about that. I think that relationship took time. In fact, I think if the Star Trek universe teaches us anything, it is that it takes time in order to build up a tolerance of this particular species. I mean, for Dax, who was probably the most tolerant, I think, of Quark and of the Ferengi, I mean, 357 years, 8 lifetimes, and she's finally gotten to the place where she can appreciate the Ferengi for what they are. But for most other folks in the Federation, for the Chief O'Briens and for the Kira Narises, they're difficult to swallow sometimes because their society is so misogynistic and it's so opposite. I mean, 180 degrees opposite of the Federation.
While all of that's the case, Mike, there's something a little inconsistent about the way that the Federation treats cultural assimilation inside the Star Trek universe. I mean, in general, when we see a culture being destroyed inside the Star Trek universe, that's a tragic thing. That's something to be stopped. That's a reason not to interact with that culture or have the influence, the degree of influence that you might have, because there's a danger of losing the cultural integrity of a group of individuals. And with the Ferengi, I think in Star Trek, we kind of want to have it the other way around. The Ferengi are so unvirtuous from the human standpoint in science at the beginning, definitely the beginning of Star Trek The Next Generation, and even a good portion of the way into Deep Space Nine. The Ferengi are not, from the human standpoint, are not something to be emulated or idolized. They are unvirtuous. So their trajectory towards being more integrated with humans and having a tighter interaction with the Federation, even to the point where Nog, a Ferengi, is going to Starfleet Academy, there's a cultural assimilation going on. Why isn't that as sad or as tragic as, say, any other, you know, first contact situation in Star Trek, or any other case of violating the Prime Directive with a concern about cultural assimilation and its disastrous consequences? Why don't we have that sad reaction when we talk about the Ferengi becoming more Federation-like?
Well, I think it comes down to our own attitudes often towards these ideas. I mentioned that the Ferengi were very misogynistic, but on the same hand, a society who prides itself on the sixth rule of acquisition, never allow family to stand in the way of opportunity, and yet we learn so much about the Ferengi and their attitudes towards family, especially in the episode The Magnificent Ferengi, in which Quark and Rom and Nog and a few other choice Ferengi characters mount a rescue mission to rescue Moogie from the Dominion. And, you know, they're willing to risk their lives, to lay their lives down on the line in order to save Quark and Rom's mother. So I think that it's, to answer your question, it's our own attitudes towards kind of the misogyny of this society and their general capitalistic attitudes. It seems so contrasting in this world of tolerance and diversity, and where, you know, there isn't the consternation of going out and earning profit, but rather we work to better ourselves, as Captain Picard put it. And so that's so contrasting, you know, and I don't want to get political, but I find it interesting that in the political dialogue of late, oftentimes President-elect Trump has been compared to a Ferengi. In fact, I've seen memes of, you know, his face superimposed on a Ferengi's head and those kinds of things. And we chuckle and we laugh, but we draw these comparisons to these attitudes, Zachary, that we have grown accustomed to not liking, to not have an appreciation for. And we see them in this character and we just loathe them. But really, as all characters in the Star Trek universe, as all species in the Star Trek universe, the Ferengi really do represent a piece, if you will, of our own humanity.
You know, I don't want to spend too much time talking about contemporary politics, because that's not what we're about here. No, on Metatrex.
Absolutely.
We tend to steer away from contemporary politics. On the other hand, there are some pieces of dialogue involving the Ferengi that were politically relevant, say, 20... Well, how many years ago? Almost 25 sure. years ago, right? That don't play as well now as they did then. Like the phrase that I used before, a kinder, gentler Grand Negus, or a kinder, gentler Ferenginar. That's a direct quote from President H.W. Bush Sr., George Bush Sr.
I want a kinder and gentler nation.
That if you forget that quote, you're not making that connection. You forget that that's a direct sort of political commentary and political reference to the events of the time. And you know, at the time, President George H.W. Bush was calling for a kinder, gentler mm-hmm. nation, a kinder, gentler America, a kinder, gentler Republican Party. And you know, the Republican Party traditionally being perceived as being motivated by profit, in bed with the oil industry, and many other connotations. That's just how the Republican Party has been perceived over time. And so when we have President H.W. Bush saying we need a kinder, gentler nation as a Republican with ties to big oil and whatnot, this is very similar to the Ferengi with all of their motivations of profit and big business. To have the Grand Negus come along saying we need a kinder, gentler Ferenginar, that's very much commentary on the political situation of the early 90s.
Without a doubt. And another great quote that you'll find in Star Trek regarding the Ferengi, and that is when Quark says, "The line must be drawn here, this far, no further." At least we know in a kinder, gentler Ferenginar, the last bastion of Ferengi virtue ethics can be found out there at the mouth of the wormhole, deep, deep, deep in the Alpha Quadrant.
At Quark's. But we also see inside Star Trek that even a being like a Ferengi at its most greedy and its most reprehensible can still turn on a dime and show that, for lack of a better term, human side, and show compassion and have a change of heart. And that is never beyond hope inside the Star Trek universe, even for the most reprehensible of characters that we see.
Zachary, we've focused a lot of the conversation, and rightly so, as we're talking about Ferengi virtue ethics, on the Ferengi greed and their desire to gain profit. But as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I think there's something to be said of the Ferengi attitude towards family. And I don't think that we talk enough about family within the Ferengi culture. It's a culture in which families really are tight-knit to some degree, because again, we see multiple instances, multiple examples of Ferengi family units working together. And I find that very interesting. And I find it very satisfying, to be quite honest with you. And even with Quark's attitudes towards Nog joining the Federation, I mentioned, you know, Quark and his mom going after his mom, and they had a tumultuous relationship, certainly. And Quark and his nephew Nog have this tumultuous relationship. He doesn't support Nog's desire to be a Starfleet officer. And so we come to the siege of AR-558, and there's a scene in that particular episode that I just find fascinating, and it's one that it's an image in my mind that it doesn't easily fade, and that is as Nog is laying there being treated because he's just been shot and he's going to lose his leg. He's laying there undergoing treatment as this terrible battle is happening just outside this cave. And a Jemadar manages to break the perimeter and thrusts himself through the orifice of the cave into the cave. And Quark turns around, spreads himself over Nog in a very protective manner, and shoots the Jemadar. And again, there's something about that image that doesn't fade easily for me. And that is something that I don't think that we give Ferengi credit for. And that is their fierce attitudes towards their family units, regardless of what might be going on, what the arguments might be, what the disagreements might be. They can be fiercely loyal and fiercely protective of their families, and I just don't think that they get the credit that they deserve for that.
I guess there's two things that come to my mind in response to that. One is it's possible that the display of affection and the display of concern for Nog that you're seeing from Quark is itself a result of his longstanding contact with humans, that Quark has become so culturally assimilated that he's become more human-like in his reactions in situations like that. That's the sort of critical, you know, almost cynical response in response to what you had to say there. I'm not sure if that's true or not. I think that's, you're probably right that the concern for Nog by Quark is deeper than that. And that reveals something about the complexity of the Ferengi social structure, that this concern for family is somehow woven in with their concern for profit in some deep way that maybe we don't fully understand based on what we see on screen. I guess my other thought is that the connection between being power hungry or greedy or concerned for profit is not necessarily so counterintuitively disassociated from concern for family. Like right now, I'm going to drop a very old reference here, but I'm rewatching the original Dallas right now with J.R. Ewing and whatnot. And in that show, we see a power hungry family that is involved in big oil and all of the moral corruption that goes along with big business. But whenever there's a threat to the family, the Ewings in that show circle the wagons and they look out for themselves. And that is part of what it means to maintain their web of power and their web of influence. And so is it a similar situation for the Ferengi? Is this concern for family a function of circling the wagons to protect their own power, protect their own sphere of influence, to protect their own whether it's political position or monetary position or whatnot, is it circling the wagons, like protecting your own and to keep the danger at bay? Or is it more of genuine concern? Is it an instinctive response to care for one's loved ones and care for one's family? Is that the other side of the coin to Ferengi greed? Yes, they're greedy. They have a concern for profit, but they do love their family, like you would expect from any family unit. Mm-hmm. Is that a sincere emotion, or is this more like what you see in Dallas with the Ewing circling the wagons whenever there's a threat to the family?
Yeah, you can argue that Quark has been largely influenced by the Federation. We know that Rom loved his brother and tells him as much inside of Deep Space Nine. And again, you can argue that Rom was influenced largely by his relationships within the Federation and his exposure to Chief O'Brien and other Federation citizens on Deep Space Nine. But I do know, Zachary, that Rule of Acquisition 31, never make fun of a Ferengi's mother. And I find it...
It's bad for business.
It's very bad for business. And again, I think it's fascinating that here's another Rule of Acquisition that is directly related to family and their attitudes towards family, again, that I find very satisfying.
But I think it's revealing that you can take any one of those rules of acquisition and you can say, because it's good for business or because it's bad for business at the end of it. And that still reads very much like a Ferengi rule of acquisition and doesn't actually change the character of the rule much at all. So I guess, you know, we don't really know. All we're doing is speculating. But you could arguably say that this concern for family does not run very deep, that profit is still such an overriding factor that the Ferengi would be willing to sacrifice their own mother in certain situations.
Or as we've mentioned already, kill your own brother, as Rom was willing to do.
On the other hand, we see so many displays of affection that it's not easy to tell whether that display of affection is a result of genuine Ferengi care for one's family and loved ones, very similar to human concern for family, or frankly, any other species we see in Star Trek's concern for family. Or whether that is a function of cultural assimilation of the Ferengi, in this case, Quark in particular, and Rom and Nog and the other Ferengi who have a large degree of interaction with humans and with the Federation, whether that's part of their cultural assimilation that is genuinely distinct from how Ferengi interact with each other apart from that cultural context.
Well, again, as we talked about the contradictions that exist within Ferengi society, rule of
like, for example, we stop seeing whips at a certain point, and I know we're all disappointed about
and
that.
I'm so glad we stopped seeing energy whips. Speaking of contradictions. I couldn't be happier that we stopped seeing energy whips. But, you know, among those contradictions, and certainly this was probably something that Rom had maybe written on his hand when he was contemplating murdering his brother. Rule of acquisition number 6, never allow family to stand in the way of opportunity. You know, it could be argued that, you know, despite it all, you know, Rom is a good Ferengi and certainly worthy to be Grand Nagus.
But only a kinder, gentler Grand Nagus in a kinder, gentler Ferenginar.
Well, again, you mentioned a kinder, gentler Grand Nagus. We see an instance in Deep Space Nine in which the Grand Nagus goes into the wormhole. And in effect, the prophets, the wormhole aliens, alter his character, and he comes out of the wormhole benevolent. And in fact, he is revising the rules of acquisition to really promote that benevolence and that altruistic change that's taken place in his own life. And it could be argued, Zachary, that the prophets didn't really do anything to him that wasn't already in his own makeup. So maybe this is an exploration for another podcast, but, you know, can we argue that on the other side of this greed that exists in Grand Nagus Zek, is there also that altruistic nature as well?
Well, I guess that's the main question, right? Is that change a function of exposing these things that really are Ferengi in nature and really were inside the Grand Nagus, kind of revealing them to the world in some sort of authentic sense? Or is that a genuine change away from traditional Ferengi attitudes and traditional Ferengi belief systems towards a new belief system, the new Ferenginar, with new virtues that happen to be more human-like? It reminds me a lot of the transition from Saul to Paul on the road to Damascus, right? It's a transformation moment. And like any transformation moment, you can ask yourself the same question. Is that change a matter of revealing something that was already there to begin with? Or is that change a genuine change to the point where it's a different individual, different virtues, and a different worldview? And is it a large degree of change in some sort of personal identity sense? Or is that a matter of revealing a person's inner nature that really was there all along?
Well, Zachary, we are rounding about an hour here and winding down our conversation. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share on the Ferengi and virtue ethics?
While I don't think we have enough information to really settle the issue of whether Ferengi virtues and Ferengi behaviors and Ferengi character traits are innate or whether they're learned behaviors, we've talked about a lot of different ways of cutting that up here during the episode. I really do appreciate the way that the Ferengi are depicted over time in Star Trek. The transition from an evil villain with all of our worst character traits, greed and power and lust and violence, you know, that's how the Ferengi are depicted when they're first introduced. Mm-hmm. The transition from that into characters that are largely relatable to the point where they can often take the moral high ground above humans is quite a contrast. And that's a very Star Trek thing to do, to take something that is perceived as evil or something that's not understood and humanize it to the point where it's relatable, that we can something we can form a relationship with, something we can relate to. That's just a very Star Trek approach to something we don't understand or something we don't relate to or something that we perceive as different from ourselves to the point of being evil or being scary or being not desirable. And Star Trek is always aiming towards unification, that we can take these differences in virtues or in behaviors or in worldviews, and somehow we can all come together and find a way to live together. And maybe that means, you know, that there'll be a cultural unification at some point, that like Spock says in the episode Unification, that the Romulans are on this inevitable trajectory towards a Vulcan philosophy, mm-hmm. right? That's possible, that what we see in Star Trek is this progressive unification of values and virtues and behaviors and cultural integration. On the other hand, it just could mean that despite whatever innate differences there are from species to species or from individual to individual, we can learn to get along and we can learn to live together on a space station and not have a violent encounter when we encounter those kinds of situations. So I think the Ferengi are a really good example of Star Trek at its best in terms of taking something that is undesirable in the world, something to be afraid of, something that's not understood, and humanizing it and making it something relatable and revealing our highest virtues, the fact that we can all live together in, frankly, it sounds like a cliche, but live together in peace and harmony.
Brilliant. I couldn't agree more. I couldn't have said that better myself. In closing, I'm going to basically say something I've already said, and that is that I hope our listeners will take the time to listen to the discussion that we've had and frame the Ferengi really in a different light, because I hear fans oftentimes say that they're annoyed by the Ferengi, they don't like the comedic tropes that the writers use within the Star Trek universe, and yeah, sometimes they are the comic relief for an episode, especially during the Dominion War arc that kind of carried on throughout the last half of the Deep Space Nine series. But that being said, I think that the Ferengi get a bad rap for being this one-dimensional, you know, species that are just completely focused on profit. And I just don't think that's true. I think there's so much more to this species. I think they're beautifully nuanced and unique, and I think they're worthy of exploration within the Star Trek universe. And so I hope that our listeners will take the time to listen to some of the things that we've said here and really see them in a new light. And also, I want to just encourage our listeners to, Zachary mentioned at the top of the podcast, this may become a series. You know, as we talk about virtue ethics among species, you know, what would our listeners like to hear next, Zachary? Perhaps we've done Klingon virtue ethics. We've done now Ferengi virtue ethics. Do we do Cardassian virtue ethics? Do we do Romulan virtue ethics?
See, Mike, I'm thinking we need to go even a little deeper than that and try to get some non-humanoid races in. So I think we need to do the virtue ethics of the Shellyak.
It wouldn't be difficult for us to explore that. We only see them once, at least on screen in the Star Trek universe.
You'd have to be extremely precise in your language. It might take pages and pages and pages of negotiations to get that spelled out just right.
Yeah, and perhaps thousands of years for us to really figure it all out.
See, Mike, if you thought it was complicated to talk about the Ferengi rules of acquisition, just wait till we talk about the Shellyak. The answer is hidden way down there in section 501, paragraph 716, subparagraph 5. You really have to look for it.
That may take some time for us to explore.
You better start now.
Well, one thing about it, I'll give the Ferengi, you know, two extra points in the fact that they are snappier dressers than the Shellyak. After all, rule of acquisition 47, don't trust a man wearing a better suit than your own.
Dress for success. Good for business.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about the Ferengi and virtue ethics, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And one of the things that I caught, you know, was a line that he said in his, you know, if I was to jump every time I saw a blinking light around here, I'd wind up talking to myself, right? And I was thinking of Star Trek V. And I was like, okay, so that wasn't an original line. I had just kind of forgotten that.
To the journey!
What would you have done?
Well, I'd have, like, programmed my tricorder, open the door, lob it in, shut the door quick. Try that, first of all.
So you would lob a tricorder probe into the holodeck.
Hope it doesn't break as it lands.
Well, you could wrap it in like some gaffer tape or something.
Some bubble wrap.
Melodic Treks.
I really like the ant scene.
Okay.
The red ants.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool and it really fit. And I really hated the gopher at the beginning.
Yes.
Because I'm like, George Lucas, get your greasy fingers off this movie, okay?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. And as Liquidator Brunt would say, another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter into space and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we've discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
To leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our MetaTreks show page on the Trek FM website, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're on Facebook, find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not separating your slips, strips, and bars of latinum, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's Voyager podcast, along with one of our associate producers from MetaTreks, Kay Shaw and Suzanne Williamson. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruehling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruehling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not playing with your Quark speak and spell, where can people find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, around the network, I can be found on recent episodes of The Ready Room, as well as occasional visits over on the NX-01 at Warp 5. You can always chat with me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, certainly around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, our founder and publisher here at Trek FM, executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, our art director Aaron Harvey, production manager Richard Marquez, and our Patreon manager Brandon Shea Mutala. Also, we'd like to give a shout-out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MagicDrop5. And one of your co-hosts from over at To The Journey, Kay Shaw, is one of our associate producers. You can connect with Kay on Twitter as well. Her Twitter handle is @ChocoWeeble. And our good friend Norm Lau. You can connect with Norm on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @Starfighter1701. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.